Ladies, I'm not going to need this today, so I'm going to kind of move this over here so I can see everybody. Okay. How's everybody doing this morning, this afternoon? Good? Good. Got a lot of spiritual food going on here? Being fed? Good. Today, I am going to be sharing my personal journey of the hell that I went through and what I had to do to be whole and to overcome. And before I tell this story, I always tell my audiences that this is my story. And some of the things you may hear, you know, maybe you won't understand, or maybe they'll tug at your heart and you will hurt. And I just ask you to ask yourself what's going on right now. I also need you to know that my parents are my heroes. Bob and Joy Roland are my example, my best friends. And some of the things I share with you are tough because my parents made a lot of mistakes as they were raising my brother and I. And because of those mistakes, I ended up with a full-fledged addiction that nearly took my life. And my brother is now in his 40s, and we still pray that he will somehow get in touch with his childhood and get in touch with his anger. But the things I'm going to say are going to be tough. And some of you may be thinking, well, she's really hard on her parents. But I need you to know that I love and adore my parents because they gave me the permission to say, this hurt me, this damaged me. And as a result, we have a wonderful relationship. When I was 28 years of age, I was an award-winning television news reporter. I had a great life. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas, Channel 4 News. Maybe some of you are from Arkansas. I reported the news every day. I was on live reports at night at 6 o'clock, at 10 o'clock, and I anchored the morning news at 6:25 and 7:25, 2 days a week. It was a great job. I went to Six and Ezra Church of Christ, went to church every Sunday, but I wore a mask. See, I was afraid to tell what my life really was like. I had a secret addiction called bulimia orexia. I was addicted to dieting. The feeling I had inside of me was, if I could just be thin enough, then I'll be happy. Then I'll get the job. Then I'll be complete. Let me tell you what a typical day was like for me at age 28. This was totally in secret. No one knew. I would get up in the morning and I would exercise very excessively. I would go run 2 to 4 miles, go work out at the spa, and then I'd go to work. When I get to work, my assignments editor would say, go do the report on the governor or the report on the school board or a murder or car wreck or whatever. I would go out, do my story. I would come back, sit down, and start typing up my story. And there would always be what I called my monster inside. There would be this click, and the click would say, okay, Cynthia, it's time. Destroy yourself. I would then reach into my purse, get a bunch of quarters, and I would run upstairs to the candy bar machine where I would put in quarter after quarter after quarter, and it wouldn't be anything for me to buy 5, 6, 8 candy bars. I would rip open the package as fast as I could, eat all of the candy bars, never tasting anything. And immediately when it hit my stomach, the panic would be, get rid of it, Cynthia, you're going to get fat, get rid of it. I would then go into the bathroom where I'd make sure nobody was. I would try to self-induce vomit, and then I would go downstairs and I would start popping laxatives and diuretics all day long. At 6 o'clock after I did my story, it would be time for dinner. And on the way to the cafeteria, I had a different grocery store that I stopped at every night. And I can remember one night, I stopped at a 7-Eleven store, and I had bought so much food, the guy knew me from television, and he said, hey, Cynthia, you having a party down at the station? And I would say, yeah, yeah, I'm having a party. And then I'd run into the car, get in the car, and rip open everything that I bought, and I would pop laxatives and diet pills between each bite. That was on the way to the cafeteria. At the cafeteria, I would buy a whole meal, sit in the corner, eat the meal, pop pills between each bite. On the way out, I'd buy 2 candy bars, and on the way back to work, I would stop at a chicken restaurant. I would go through the drive-in window, I'd buy the chicken, the coleslaw, everything, and by the time I got back to work, literally, my stomach looked like it was 9 months pregnant. My back would ache, my muscles would ache, and a lot of people have asked me, well, didn't anybody notice, you know, that you look 9 months pregnant? My colors in my clothes were always black, navy blue, and dark brown. I always wore big baggy suits to cover so nobody would know. I'd go to work sick, starting to feel nauseated because of all the abuse, the medicine that I had taken, but I'd have to go out on a story. And within me, there was a panic of losing my job. If I lose my job, I'll be nobody. So I'd go out my story. At 10 o'clock, I'd go home. I lived out in the country because I realized now that I lived out in the country because I didn't want anybody coming to visit me. I didn't want anybody knowing about my secret. And on the way home, there were three McDonald's. I would stop at each McDonald's, go through the drive-in window, buy two ice cream sundaes, Big Macs, whatever, and then I'd get home to an empty house. I would pop more pills because the panic was you're going to get fat, get rid of it, and then I'd get into bed. And every night, I would want to cry wet tears, but they would never come. And then I'd go to sleep. And then all night long, my stomach would hurt, and I would have diarrhea all night long because of the laxative abuse. And then I'd get up the next morning, and my stomach would be flat as a pancake. And I'd get up, and I'd always say, this is the day I'm going to stop. This is the day I'm going to get in control. This is the day I'll go on a good diet. So I wouldn't eat for 3 days. And then after 3 days of drinking nothing but water, the monster would say, do it, Cynthia, destroy yourself. When did it begin? When I was 16 years of age, my father, who was president of Columbia Christian College in Portland, Oregon, had resigned, and we had to move to Oklahoma City, where he became a director of the American Citizenship Center at Oklahoma Christian. And it was my senior year in high school. Now, mothers, if you're making a move, please get in touch with your kids' feelings about that move, because I had gone to a private school all of my life. My senior year, I went from Portland, Oregon, and if anybody's here from Oregon, it is green and snow mountains and oceans and trees, and I went to Oklahoma, and there was red mud and a few trees around. And to a 16-year-old girl, that was very devastating, very shocking. And then I went to public school where I was a little fish in a big pond, and I started stuffing my food. See, in my family, we didn't say, I'm angry, I'm hurting. We need to talk about this. I can remember my father saying, honey, this is like a death for you, but we're going to do it. But we never really talked about feelings, and I didn't even know what my feelings were. And so my senior year, I started stuffing my feelings, and I gained weight. And right before my graduation, my dad said to me, honey, you have really gained weight, and I want you to be thin for college. So if you lose 10 pounds, I will pay you $300. And to a 16-year-old girl, this sounded really good, but what I didn't know was there was a little girl locked up inside that was saying, Daddy won't love me unless I'm thin. And so a friend said to me, hey, if you want to lose weight, this is the way to do it. Don't eat, or when you do eat, make yourself throw up and take laxatives. And I thought, hey, what a great idea. I didn't lose 10 pounds that summer, ladies and gentlemen. I lost 17 pounds. And my dad added $30 to each pound lost above 10 pounds. I lost the weight because I wanted Daddy so desperately to love me. I didn't know it at the time, but that was one of the key issues. I went to college, and the addiction began. One laxative a week turned into five a day because the sickness says, hey, five, you know, if you take 10, you'll lose more weight. And then 20, and then 30. And by the time I was 28 years of age, I was taking up to 60 to 100 laxatives, diuretics, and diet pills a day. It is literally by the grace of God that I stand before you today. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, didn't you know this was abnormal? Didn't you know that this was kind of sick? Honestly, I didn't. I honestly didn't, because I thought this was just a great way to lose weight until I was 24 years of age, and I had my first television news job in Dallas, Texas. And I can remember going to a grocery store, and I was on a real high. There's a real high if your addiction is whatever, drugs, alcohol, food. There's a real high when I thought I can eat all this food and not gain any weight. Well, I went into a Safeway store, and I started going down the aisle with my cart and got all my food. And in the store, there was a jar of peanuts, and I had to have those peanuts then. I got the jar of peanuts, opened them up, ate three-fourths of the jar, and I put the lid back on the jar and put it back on the shelf. Didn't think, Cynthia, you need to pay for this. Didn't even think that. Went around the corner, came to a refrigerator where some hot dogs were. And I had to have those hot dogs. I remember looking to make sure nobody was watching me, and I took the package of the hot dogs out, opened them, ate two of them quickly, and put the rest of the package back into the refrigerator. Went around the corner, and a man approached me. He was an undercover cop. And he said, lady, I saw what you did with the peanuts. And in my mind, I was going, what about the wieners? And I lied, and I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, lady, I'm paid to do this job. You came in the store, you opened up a jar of peanuts, you ate them. That's called stealing. You didn't pay for them. That's called shoplifting. And I'm going to let you go today, but if you ever come in the store and do this again, I will arrest you and put you in jail. And it was at that moment of truth that I said, you are sick. Something is wrong. You need help. I didn't buy the groceries. I didn't eat for 2 days. And on Monday at age 23, I was 23 actually, I started looking for help. And from 23 to 28, I went to over 18 different professionals and not one knew what to do. When I would go to a doctor and I would say, look, I eat 10 candy bars and I take pills and I make myself throw up, they'd go, you do what? Well, stop it. Don't you know that's bad for you? Yeah. Two psychiatrists in two different cities said to me, you know, Cynthia, what you need is a man and everything will be all right. That was not the answer for me at that time. I was incapable of loving or receiving love. Christian therapists would say, just trust in God and everything will be all right. I was trying and nothing was all right. At age 28, I went to my last doctor. And the last doctor I went to, I was ready to give up. By the time I was 28, literally this addiction had consumed me to the point where I didn't care about news reporting anymore. I went to work, but it seemed that I'd go to work and I'd leave work and I would go and go to the all-you-can-eat salad bar and the smorgasbords. I was totally out of control. And I had fasted for 3 days and I had taken some over-the-counter drugs on an empty stomach. And I woke up the next morning after I'd done this and I could not feel on my right side. I could not see and I could not hear. My heart felt like it was coming out of my chest, and I knew at that point I was going to die. And what was so strange about that was I wanted to die, but I didn't, but I did, but I didn't. I crawled to the kitchen where a doctor had given me some potassium pills and told me if I'm going to do this, drink a lot of Gatorade. And I went in, and by this time I was having Charlie horses from my neck to my toes. I could hardly move. I drank a big gallon of Gatorade because when you do this, it flushes every nutrient, every vitamin, everything out of your body to the point where your heart can't stop. I looked down, my fingers were blue, and I thought, I'm going to die. I didn't want to die. I called a friend, my one friend who knew about my addiction. She came to get me, and she said, Cynthia, you look like you're going into shock. And she rushed me to a doctor that had gone to her, went to her church, and he saw us immediately. And by this time, I had my mask on. I was embarrassed. I thought, oh, you know, he's not going to help me. And my friend got really upset, and she said, she has what is called bulimia. She's addicted to binging and purging and starving, and last night she didn't eat, and she overdosed on laxatives. You've got to help her. And the doctor looked at me, and he said, well, I think it's just nerves. And he gave me a prescription for Valium. And he sent me home. And it was at that moment of truth that I said, if 18 different doctors cannot help me, who possibly can help me? And for 2 weeks, I decided this was it. I was not going to live any longer. And I will never forget the day as long as I live. It was in April. The sun was shining, and I remember thinking, why is the sun shining? Because this is the day I'm going to die. And I had a feeling in my head, get a gun, just take your life. And I called my neighbors to borrow a gun. They were hunters, and I had this story all made up that, you know, so I had heard noises outside my house, and I called them, and they weren't home. And I lay down on my couch waiting for them to come home, trying to cry wet tears, and they would not come. And I battled with a person named God that I had been taught about all my life. And I said, God, if you are alive, you better help me now, or there's not going to be a Cynthia Rowland anymore. 2 hours passed. My neighbors never came home, but my phone rang. It was my one friend, Joan. And she said, Cynthia, this morning at my church, there was a woman that testified that she nearly died of bulimia. And she went to a very special psychiatric clinic in Dallas, Texas. And I think you should call, and I think you should go. And I will tell you, when I got off the phone, there were two feelings inside, two forces inside of me. And it was on that day that I knew there was a Satan fighting for my soul and there was a God fighting for my soul. One side of me said, Cynthia, you're no good. Take your life. You've been to 18 different doctors. Just end your life. And the other side said, no, this is hope. You hang on. I called the clinic. They had no beds available. I had to wait a week. I went to work, continued my binging and purging because I was totally out of control, and then I got the phone call to go to the hospital. I went and told my boss about it. He couldn't believe it, but he gave me my blessings. And I said, Gary, I'll be gone 2 weeks. 2 weeks, that's all. I'll go there and I'll be back in 2 weeks. I drove down to Dallas, Texas, arrived at this clinic at midnight, and as I looked at the clinic inside my car, I downed a big box of laxatives because the panic was, you're going to have to stop, Cynthia. You're going to get fat now, Cynthia. But as I looked at the clinic, I said to myself, either I learn to live or I am going to die. At midnight, I went into a locked unit where I didn't live for 2 weeks. I lived for almost 3 months of my life. And in that hospital, I found out why my blind eyes were blind and how they had to be open to why people hurt. They monitored me physically for a month, but for 2 weeks they monitored me for a heart attack because my potassium level was so low. Dr. Minnis couldn't even believe I was alive. I went totally off the drugs, and I didn't know it, but I was an over-the-counter drug addict. I went through shakes and sweats. It hurt to take a shower. I remember a nurse tried to hug me, and it hurt to be touched because, see, I had been numbing feelings for so long that I was feeling, but I didn't know what was going on. It took me a month before I had a normal bowel movement. And see, if you are bulimic in this room, you know how insane I felt because there was always this feeling of, I got to get cleaned out, I'm dirty, I've got to get cleaned out. But I had to go off of the drugs in order to overcome the addiction to those pills. But what was wrong? What was wrong? I told you the symptom. But what was wrong? I had a therapist by the name of Mike Moore. And Mike, I didn't understand therapy. You know, only crazy people go to psych wards. And being a Christian, I didn't need therapy, but I knew I had to do something or I was going to die. And in therapy, it was basically getting into the heart. It was talking. It was remembering. And one day I was down the end of the hall, and Mike yelled at me. And he said, hey, Cynthia, when did you become damaged freight? Huh, Cynthia? And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't have any idea. But when he did that, the monster's chain rattled inside. And one day in group therapy, there was a teenager who had attempted suicide. And he had to leave the hospital because his insurance had run out. And I started crying wet tears. And Mike looked at me and he said, what are you crying for, Cynthia? He's the one that's leaving, not you. And I said, because he's so lonely. And Mike said, lonely? Now, that's a good word, Cynthia. Tell us about loneliness. When did you become damaged freight, huh, Cynthia? And a memory came in my mind, and it is a memory that I would relive over and over and over again the 3 months I was in that hospital. Imagine this. I'm 4 years of age, and I'm bouncing on a bed, and I'm playing with my brother, and we're laughing, and we're having a great time. But right next to the bed, my mother had made a homemade vaporizer, which was a burning hot burner with a big pan of boiling water, and she'd put Vicks in it. We had colds, and it was supposed to help our sinuses. But it had been boiling, and she'd been adding boiling water all night. And as my brother and I were playing, my brother accidentally pushed me too hard, and my little four-year-old body fell into the boiling water. Tell us about loneliness, Cynthia. When did you become damaged freight, huh, Cynthia? I was critically burned on my thighs, stomach, and vagina, 4 years of age. And I could remember being in a hospital room, and my mommy and daddy never came to visit me. And I remember I had a roommate by the name of Susie, and she scared me because she looked like a mummy. She was wrapped up from the top of her head to her toes. And I could remember saying, Susie, why are you here in the hospital? And Susie said, my mother threw me in the oven. Tell us about loneliness, Cynthia. When did you become damaged freight, huh, Cynthia? There was a girl that was bulimic in the hospital, and she had been raped when she was 14 years of age, and every time she relived it, it affected me, and I thought it was because I cared about her, but one day I found out it was much, much more. She was having dreams where she couldn't breathe, and Mike made her relax in group and ask her, you know, why can't you breathe? And she remembered as a child she had asthma, and her dad would put her on top of a slab of wood on the bathtub and put boiling water. Apparently the steam helped her asthma, but as a little girl, she didn't know what was going on, and she would move, and her dad would hold her down and say, shut up, little girl, be still, little girl. I guess he was afraid of her falling into the boiling water, but as she was reliving this, a memory came to my mind. I'm in that hospital bed. My mom and dad never come to see me. Susie's over here, and her mommy and daddy never come to see her. And I remember trying to sleep, and I'm in a lot of pain. I'm wrapped up from my waist down, and they're putting all these lights and medicines on my body, and I don't understand what's going on. But all of a sudden, the door opens. I can still hear the boom. And these big people walk in, and they have white masks on and white suits on. And they come around my bed, and they don't say to me, "Honey, we're going to have to do this to save your life," or "Honey, we're going to do a skin graft." They don't say anything to me. Instead, they put me on my back, and they open up my little four-year-old legs, and they start ripping and ripping at my body. And I thought I had been a bad little girl. And I looked at a nurse, who I still have flashbacks about being very verbally and emotionally abusive to me, and I looked at this nurse, and I said, "Have I been bad? What have I done? Please leave me alone. Let me go to sleep." And the nurse turned around, looked at me, and said, "Then shut up, little girl, and go to sleep." And when I came out of that memory, Mike said, "You feel like you've been raped, don't you, Cynthia?" And I said, "Yes, yes. What were they doing to me?" And I looked at a nurse and I said, "What were they doing to me?" And she said, "Cynthia, you were critically burned. And most likely they were doing something to save your life." What I have since learned from nurses in my audiences is they were doing something called debriding. When you are burned, they literally, with the fingertips, have to take off the dead skin. Now they would put a child under. Now they would numb the area, but back then they were ignorant and they didn't know and they did nothing. My parents came into therapy with me. And I will say at this point that if parents are not involved with their children's therapy, their adult children's therapy, sometimes it's tough for that child, that adult child, to get on with their life. And my dad was very busy. I was very ashamed. I didn't even tell my parents I was going to a psych ward. They found out when my doctor called and said, "Your daughter is near death." But they came into therapy with me, and I was very afraid of what was going to happen. But the first question I asked them was, "Where were you when I was 4 years of age?" And Mike made me relive everything that I went through. And Mom and Dad said, "Honey, we were out in the waiting room the entire time you were in that hospital." See, I'm 39 years old right now. And so 35 years ago, they did not allow people into the burn unit, but nobody told me this. And so I locked up these feelings of abandonment, these feelings that my mom and dad must not love me. I revealed that I felt like I had been raped, and I told them what had happened. They had no idea what was going on. I had to confront a lot of things with my father and mother, especially my dad, because my dad was the one in the family that got angry. And he was the one that expressed himself. And he was the one that we had to be perfect for, the preacher and the president of the college. And I had to say, "Dad, this damaged me. This hurt me. When you did this, I will never forget this." And guess what my father did? If you know my dad, he's 6'3" and he's a big, charismatic man. He wept. And he said, "I am so sorry." He said, "I have blown it as a father. And I know that, and you don't know how many times I've kicked myself, but I need you to forgive me." And then some other things were said in that therapy session that I believe were my truths. All my life, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. I never felt like I belonged with any group. I wasn't particularly a loner, but I always kind of ran around with underdogs. And I realize now that damaged little girl was trying to be a savior to many, many people. But all of my life, even though I was a news reporter and I looked the part of success, inside I didn't like myself and I felt very insecure. And the four-year-old experience really was the key to a lot of things, but I believe it started before then. One day Mike did some hypnosis with me, which is merely remembering and just thinking about things that have happened to you. And he told me, he said, "Cynthia, I want you to go back as far as you want to go back, and I want you to tell me what you see." And I saw four pictures. And the first picture I saw was I was inside my mother. I was inside her womb, and there was movement, constant movement. And I felt like my mother was hitting her stomach. And I said to Mike, I said, "Mike, my mother does not want me." And the second picture I saw was I was coming out of my mother and she was screaming. And I said, "Mike, I'm killing my mother." The third picture I saw was I was in this pretty bassinet and I was moving, wasn't crying. I wanted somebody to pick me up and nobody did. And then the fourth picture I saw was I was this little baby, bald hair. And I was in the arms of a woman who had huge, huge bosom. I mean, just huge. And she was holding me, the baby, like this. And my face was this way. And in front of me was a church, white trees, stairs in front, and people, and my dad were in front. And my dad was hugging people, and the baby was saying, "Why is this woman holding me? I want my daddy to hold me." Mike said to my mother, "Mrs. Rowland, what kind of pregnancy did you have with Cynthia?" And my mother, and I've never discussed her pregnancy, never discussed the birth. I'm the second kid in the family. You know how that feels? Not very many pictures, you know? My mother said, "I threw up every single day of that pregnancy." Movement? In fact, Cindy was so low in my body, I thought I was going to lose her. What was the birth like? And my dad spoke up, and my dad said, "We were missionaries in Alaska, and Cindy was born in a very small hospital in Alaska. And I could hear Joy screaming as she was giving birth, and I thought I was going to lose my wife. Thought I was killing my mother." What kind of crib did Cynthia sleep in? And mother said, "Oh, she had this pretty pink bassinet." And then Mike said, "Mr. Rowland, describe the church that you preached at when she was just a baby, you know, 4 or 5 months old." And Dad said, "Well, it was made out of wood, painted white, trees around it with stairs in the front." And I said, "Was there a woman?" And I described the woman. And they said, "Yes, there was a nurse that loved you and always wanted to hold you." Now, my truth is, my belief is, that feelings of inadequacy began in the womb. It was my perception. But then when I was four years old and traumatized by the burns and the scars, and then my mom and dad weren't there, so they must not love me, it developed a feeling of, I don't belong, I am damaged freight. And my parents will tell you that I didn't like to be touched or hugged or snuggled. I never wanted to bother them. As I grew up, I was the perfect child. My brother was the rebellious child. My brother at age 9 started shoplifting. By 11 he was smoking. By 12 he was doing drugs. By 16, 18 he was dealing drugs. And my brother, what he was saying was, "Notice me." But my mom and dad said, we didn't have Dr. Dobson back then. My mother says, all we had was Dr. Spock, and he really messed us up. That's what she says. But my brother was saying, "Notice me," but my dad had to use the belt. Because, see, that was the way to get him to act right. And so my father always punished with the belt and a lot of yelling and a lot of screaming. My dad, and I will talk more about this tomorrow, but we have realized that my dad was too busy saving the world and the school and the church and not saving his own family. And we have paid the price for that. But because of my brother and my father, I had a pattern with men. And whether we want to believe it or not, we have unhealthy patterns and we have healthy patterns. But I had a very unhealthy pattern because of my father and my brother. See, my dad was unattainable. My dad was a good man, but yet I was afraid of him. And then my brother, on the other hand, was rebellious, and I was the good girl, and I always wanted to save my brother, but I couldn't. But because I was damaged, I didn't deserve a good man. And because my brother was damaged and I was damaged, then I wanted to look for damaged men. I didn't know this until I was attracted to an alcoholic in the hospital. I had no business whatsoever being attracted to this alcoholic. Went to Mike and I said, "Mike, you know, something's going on here. I don't know, and I want to find out what's wrong." He said, "Oh, Cynthia, I'll tell you what's wrong." He said, "Clint was beaten as a little boy, and your brother Bobby was beaten as a little boy, and you couldn't save your brother, so you've been looking to save your brother through every guy you've ever dated." And I thought about that, and I thought about the few people, men, that I'd been involved with. One had potential, and I was going to be the one to help him reach that potential. One had been an orphan as a child, and I was going to make his adult life wonderful. And what I found out was I didn't know that I had the right in a relationship to say, these are my needs, these are my boundaries, these are my dreams. I didn't know that I needed somebody to lift me up. You're looking to save your brother through every guy you've ever dated. And I was. All the men that I'd been involved with had been beaten, and I was going to save them. And when I processed this information, I went back to Mike and I said, "Mike, you're right. What am I going to do?" I said, "I want to get out of the hospital and I want to get married someday and I want to have a family. What do I do?" He said, "Well, Cynthia," he said, "when you get out of the hospital and a guy asks you out for a date, the first question I want you to ask him is, were you beaten as a little boy? And if he says yes, you run as fast as you can." I found out that I was going to leave in 2 weeks. I'd already been there over 2 months. Very scary thing when you relive your past, you've confronted your family, you find out that you're angry and you're sad and you've never felt and you had this traumatic experience. But in the hospital, when I was going through all this, I didn't want to live. All of a sudden, I didn't want to live. And one night, I felt very suicidal, and I was up all night with a nurse. And Mike came in the next morning, and he took me to the room, and he said, "Start talking." I said, "Mike," I said, "there's part of me that wants to live, and there's part of me that wants to die." And he got up, left the room, and came back with a bataka bat, which is a foam rubber bat. And he gave me the bat, and he got a chair, and he said, "Okay, Cynthia, okay." He said, "I want you to put every single person who hurt you, abused you, abandoned you, left you, whatever event it is, and I want you to put it in a chair, and I want you to remember it, and I want you to hit it." And I hit, and I remembered, and I cried, and I cursed, and I cried, and I wept, and I sobbed. And when it was over with, I was sick because all this poison had drained out of me. And I looked at Mike, and I said, "Mike, why didn't anybody know how desperate I was?" And he looked at me and he said, "Did you ever tell them?" And I honestly had to say, no. And he got up. And he said, "You know, Cynthia, I wonder if it's a fantasy for you to put a gun to your head and for your mom and dad to find you." He got up and left the room. I processed it, I thought about it, and he was right. You see, on that Sunday morning, had I put a gun to my head and my parents found me, the message on the wall would have been, "Where were you when I was 4 years of age? Where were you when I wanted to cry and I couldn't cry? Where were you when my brother was sobbing and I was in the room scared to death? Where were you?" And I found out that my suicidal feelings were anger turned inward. And had I committed suicide, I would be 6 feet down in the ground and my parents would be walking around wondering what had happened and grieving. And I had to learn to deal with whatever was wrong and grow up and ultimately forgive. I had one more lesson to learn, hard lesson to learn in the hospital. I had a pass out of the psych ward, went over to a friend's house. This guy and his family had kind of adopted me, and this friend had been a drug addict, and he had gone out of the hospital, quit his therapy, and had gone back to drugs, and it very, very much frightened me. And when he told me by the end of the evening, he was acting strange that he had gone back to drugs and he didn't care, I panicked because I was leaving in less than 2 weeks. I had made the decision, either I learn to live or I'm going to die. I could not go back to that way of life at all. And I went to my roommate's house to spend the night. Had never been to her house. Went up to her house, which I thought was her house, but it wasn't. But I went up to this house in Dallas, Texas, put the key in the door. The key didn't work. And instead of turning around, going to the phone, or going back to the hospital, I froze because, see, I didn't want to bother anybody. I turned around, got in the back seat of my car, and spent the night in my car. Sun came up, went back to the hospital. It was a Sunday morning. And I remember the nurses saying, "You know, well, why are you back so early?" And I said, "Oh, I just couldn't sleep," which was true. In the back seat of my car, I couldn't sleep very well. And I went and took a nap, and I got up, and I went to the day room, which is where we ate. And on this Sunday morning, nobody was in there. Usually people watched us while we ate. But I went in there, and there were these racks of donuts, these bowls of donuts. And that monster was saying, "See, he didn't make it. You're not going to make it." And I started picking up the donuts. Picking them up, eating, and I very calmly went back to my room. Nobody saw me, went to the bathroom, tried to self-destruct, and then that night I felt so guilty, I told the group what was going on. And the next day I was in art therapy, and Mike walked in. And he looked at the therapist, and he said, "You know, Cynthia here's not going to make it. She's dealing with secondary stuff." And when he said that, I started crying because I had to make it or I was going to die. And I started rocking. When I was a little girl, I used to rock. I still rock to this day. Rock, rock. And I was crying. And Mike looked at me. He said, "What are you rocking for, Cynthia?" And I stopped. He said, "I want to know, Cynthia, what are you rocking for?" And I said, "I guess because it's comforting, Mike." And he looked at me and he said, "Comfort? Now that's a good word, Cynthia. How do you get comfort?" And I said, I don't know. And I sobbed into my hands, and all of a sudden I felt these big fat arms come around me, and they started rocking with me. And Mike said, "Is this comforting, Cynthia?" I said, yeah. He said, "Okay, Cynthia, I want you to go to every single person on this psych ward, and I want you to say, I need comfort. Now, by this time, snot was rolling down my nose, and I asked to go blow my nose, and he said, no, you go as you are, and you say, I need comfort. And I went to every single person on the psych ward, and I said, I need comfort. I need comfort. And guess what I got? I got hugs, and I got, I love you, and you're going to make it. See, I don't know why, but for some reason, growing up, the unspoken messages, and the message was, don't tell anybody what you're feeling. Don't tell anybody what's going on in this family. Just trust in God. Don't bother anybody. And that philosophy nearly took my life, and I have had to learn to say, I need help. I need a hug. I need prayer. The last day I was in that hospital, Mike made me look at a really good guy. He had been severely depressed because of some deaths in his family, but he intimidated me because he's a good guy. He said, Cynthia, I want you to look at Ike, and I want you to say, Ike, I am not damaged freight, and the scars and the burns are not my fault. And I looked at Ike, and I said, I'm not damaged freight, and the scars and burns are not my fault. And this good-looking guy got up and hugged me and said, I think you're beautiful, Cynthia. And then everybody in the room went around and said, you're not damaged freight, Cynthia. You're not damaged freight. I left the hospital free. I went to Portland, Oregon, which is where all this happened. Went to the hospital, no records. My doctor has died. I will never know what they were doing to me at age 4. But as an adult, I have to believe that they were doing something to save my life. I went to the house where I grew up in. It's now a bunch of offices. And I walked in, and it's amazing when you go through your childhood how things affect you when you see something that reminds you of that. And when I walked in, I just started kind of shaking. And I walked into this house, and I went down the hallway. And I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, at nighttime when I had to go to the bathroom, that hall was so dark and so big, and I knew there was a booger bear that was going to get me. You know that feeling? Well, I walked into the hallway, and I could touch my adult hand on the roof, and it was only about this wide. It was my perception. Went into my bedroom, and I remember as a child, and even as a teenager, I would lay in bed shaking. I was so afraid. My dad always talked about the communists coming to get us, and I knew there was a communist in my closet. I knew that. But I remember shaking and wanting to say, Dad, Mom, I'm afraid, but I never wanted to bother them. I went downstairs, and this is where I had a little room where my mother had a bunch of costumes, and I would become the preacher. I become the teacher. I become the actress, the singing star, the dancer. And then I saw myself in a corner as a child. And my mother growing up had a lot of depression. My mother was sick a lot, and my mother, that was her way of dealing with her pain and her anger and her loneliness and her frustration, but I didn't understand that, and I didn't want to bother her. So a lot of times I would get money from her or have some money, and I would go down to the corner grocery store, and I would buy 5 5-cent candy bars. And I would come back to the house, and I'd go in the room, shut the door, and I saw myself as a child sitting in that corner eating 5 candy bars at one time. And I realized in that room is where I learned to turn to food to be my mom, because I didn't want to bother my mom. Food was my dad. It was my friend. It was my comfort. Jesus Christ said, know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The question that I challenge all of us today is, what is your truth? See, I believe that I am what I am today because of the past. And if the past has been good and comforting and just really having parents that will hug and love and nurture, then I'm probably going to be a pretty healthy adult. But if the past has been neglectful, and there's been some verbal messages and abuse or sexual abuse or whatever has happened, then as adults, it's going to be very tough to be whole. And I believe in the church, there's a lot of dysfunction going on within the church. And I think it is time that if we need help, we need to get it. One of my dreams is that churches will have 3 full-time therapists, Christian therapists, on staff because we are hurting in our families. 1 million teenage girls will get pregnant this year, and they will not be married. One out of four girls will be sexually abused by age 18. One out of seven boys will be sexually abused by age 18. 150,000 teenagers will die this year because of drinking and driving, and one person will die in the next 28 minutes because somebody chose to drink and drive. And when I read about those statistics, I have to remind myself those are people with beating hearts just like me. And there are reasons why they do what they do. And today I challenge you with what is your truth. I have been lecturing and ministering for the last 9 years. I went public with my story, and what happened is God just opened the doors for me to quit my television job and to do what I do right now. And I've written 3 books, and I'm just trying to give some answers to why we are the way we are. But in every audience that I speak to, primarily especially addictive audiences, I would say that 65% of the men and women I have met have been sexually abused as children, and either they don't remember it or they've never told anybody. The rest of us have been abused verbally, emotionally, physically, spiritually. I know of women who have had parents who have said, if you don't obey us, God will strike you dead right now. That is called spiritual abuse. And then the rest of us have been abandoned through death, through divorce, through an abandonment issue like I had. But I believe that there is a God of hope, that there is a God that has answers, that there is a God that loves us enough that he sent his son to die for us and for our abusers. And if you have been abused, I beg you, don't let your abusers win by being addicted or being angry or being depressed. Don't let them win, because there is a man by the name of Jesus Christ that has already died for your abusers. And I pray that if you need help, you will get it and you will be set free. I am well today because, number one, I said I'm sick and I need help. And number two, I found the professionals that knew what they were doing and they helped me save my life. And number three, I confronted my anger and my sadness and my family. And then number four, I had to forgive. And I will tell you, forgiveness did not come overnight. It was a process. But I had to forgive. I know in this audience you were hurting. I know in this audience you have sons and daughters that have left their first love, God, Jesus Christ, or the church. I know that some of you have angry kids that don't call, or maybe you just have kids that you need to say you're sorry to. I beg you to do that. Right now, I want us to close our eyes, and I want us to pray individually, and I want us to specifically put the child or the husband or the parent are the abuser right there in our mind. And then I want you to have Jesus right by your side. And what would you say to that person that you love or you hate for what they did? What would you, with Jesus' strength, do? And then I want you to picture Jesus Christ on that cross. And you are on your knees before that cross. What would you say to him? And the next picture I want you to see is Christ rising from death and coming to you with open arms. And what would he say to you? I know he said to me, Cynthia, you were damaged as a little girl, and you didn't understand, but I was always there, and I have a purpose for your life. Father, right now, I would ask that you would be with the person right now that has wept so openly. And I would ask that you would put your arms around her, or those around her would hug her. And Lord, I thank you for the freedom that only you can give. And I thank you for every person in this audience. And Lord, I know sometimes it's hard to understand the pain that we suffer. But Lord, I praise you for suffering, because through my suffering I have known you. And I know that you love me and you have purpose. Father, thank you so much for a new day. And thank you for each moment that can be a new beginning. It's in your name that I pray. Amen.